population for the protection of society, end quote. Slippery slope. It's become a cliche. But that's because it's absolutely true. Giving into one group that's offended by teaching the Holocaust or another group that wants to start a private community might not seem like a big deal. But all of those concessions begin to multiply, and you end up reliving Ion Hersey Alley's experience. Phase 3. Borders. Call me crazy, but I think it's more than a bookstore. Our current way of handling our borders, essentially hoping that people who cross them are innocent workers instead of terrorists, is going to get us all killed. It may be a guy smuggling in a nuke or a couple hundred extremists coming in over the decades to preach Western hatred and Islamism, but either way, you can't have a country without secure borders. Phase 4. Exposure. A recent report for Congress highlighted how important the internet has become for Islamic extremists. These groups have come to value the internet so much for its ability to spread their message that some have said the keyboard is as important as a Kalashnikov rifle. The report went on to talk about how extremists are able to come together online in ways that often later translate into the physical world. Remember the plot in the summer of 2006 to simultaneously bomb airplanes headed from the United Kingdom to the United States? London Police Chief Ian Blair said that the internet helped the suspects go from, quote, what would appear to be ordinary lives in a matter of some weeks and months, not years, to a position where they were allegedly prepared to commit suicide and murder thousands of people, end quote. But the power of the internet shouldn't be used only by extremists who want to expose their views to the masses. We can use it to expose them to the masses. The mainstream media outlets really have no interest in showing us what extremists say or do, or how clearly they state their threats against us. That's why it's up to you. It's up to me. It's up to all of us, the ones who understand what's happening, to spread the word. And the internet is the best way to do that. The most important thing we can do is just be aware. Lots of stuff goes unnoticed by the average American because, let's be honest, we're all busy living our lives, and we don't think small changes affect us. If you've learned anything from this section, I hope it's this. The little things do affect us. When it comes to Islamic extremists, we should sweat the small stuff. So, let's, please, stop it with the political correctness. What ties people like Select Woman Peak together with radical Islamists who want to change school curriculums is their insistence on revisionist history. Just because something happened that we don't like or agree with doesn't mean it didn't happen. There's a lot of stuff in our history we'd like to forget. The Holocaust, slavery, New Coke. But we're better off having lived through it and learned than from pretending these things just didn't exist because of some aspect of them that offends us. Remember, we're still a free society, at least the last time I checked, living under the Constitution. You may not like what I have to say, but so far, I have the right to say it without being killed. There are two fronts that must be defended in our war with Islamic extremists, our homeland and our freedoms. If we don't defend both of them, we will end up with neither. Section 4. Body image. The new hotness. Somewhere between my pink cashmere sweaters, my obsession with Yankee Candle, and of course my occasional, and by occasional I mean frequent, bouts of weeping, I'm all guy. No more, no less evolved than the workers who shout at women from construction sites. Hey, hey, baby! Unlike those masters of chivalry, I may be able to hold my tongue, but I still find it very hard to avert my eyes. A hot woman is a hot woman, and no red-blooded American male can be expected not to look. Kind of like the porn thing. It's hardwired into our DNA. Actually, I have a theory that God himself built men this way, by putting magnets in our eyes and iron plates in her butt. You know what I'm saying? It's pure biology beyond our control. I bet that even the Pope has moments when he thinks to himself, don't look at her butt, don't look at her butt. Inappropriate, inappropriate. Basically, I'm a hypocrite when it comes to women. I don't mean to be. I try really hard not to be, but I am, nonetheless. As much as I hate the idea that one day some guy will look at one of my three daughters as if she were a 28-ounce porterhouse, I can't help but do that myself to other women. It's not that I don't understand that once upon a time those unbelievably hot women were someone's little girls. It's just, damn it, it's those eye magnets. I can't stop it. And that's exactly the problem. We've become a society that completely revolves around sex. Sex sells magazines. Sex gets ratings. Sex sells products on billboards, on the internet, on television. Well, I mean, except for my show. In fact, you probably just replayed the last sentence twice because I used the word sex multiple times. Oh, I know who's listening, you freak. It's an adage as old as advertising itself. Sex sells. And nothing sells sex better than an impossibly gorgeous woman. You can find plenty of hot women hawking plenty of products. But it's what you won't find that's ultimately more important. An ounce of body fat on any of them. That's not reality. That's technology. Whatever fat or flaws these women have are conveniently photoshopped or airbrushed out well before the pictures ever appear on a 50-foot highway billboard. That's not something we usually pause to think about before hitting the TiVo slow-mo button, but it should be, especially when our kids are around. Think about it. From the day our children stop using a sippy cup, they're bombarded with images that project a nearly unattainable physical ideal. When was the last time you saw a zit on Scarlett Johansson's forehead? Yeah, that's what I thought. How about crow's feet around Madonna's eyes? Cellulite on Charlize Theron? Yeah, I'll answer for you, never. Not because they don't have those imperfections, except Charlize. She's pretty much perfect. But because they don't have them in public. A few mouse clicks here, some makeup and lighting adjustments there, poof! The effects of aging and eating disappear. And that's exactly the problem. These images may not seem dangerous right now, but they form a foundation upon which our children's self-esteem and body image is going to be based. It's not rocket science. The shakier that foundation, the more likely it is their entire house will collapse later in life. How am I supposed to convince my teenage daughter that it's okay to have a little acne when no teenage celebrity has any? When they're horrified by cellulite? What famously hot movie star can I point to and say, look at her, she must have cellulite because she's always wearing slacks? How can I convince my kids that eating a bowl of ice cream isn't a death sentence when so many of their friends believe that it is? I'm just one man. There's no way I can fight an entire culture. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to try. Between 8 and 10 million women in this country suffer from some sort of eating disorder. Even though no fancy study has wasted money confirming it yet, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that most of them are reading magazines with articles like "The Look That Keeps Him Hot for You," just before they head to the bathroom to barf up their lunch. You think I'm exaggerating? Yeah, not so much. That's an actual article title from a recent issue of Cosmo. Go ahead, Google it. I dare you. I don't use the word hate often, but I think it applies here. I hate fashion magazines. Here's something a fancy study did confirm. The more fashion magazines a girl is exposed to, the more likely she is to suffer from poor body image. I could have told you that one for free. Strictly for research purposes, of course, I had one of my staffers pick up a copy of Cosmopolitan magazine. I personally wouldn't be caught dead with Cosmo, because if I were caught dead with Cosmo, I'd be dead and I'd have no way to explain it, but anyway, among such features as smooth, sexy legs, 5 simple steps, outfits that add 5 pounds, and clothes that flatter your butt are ads. lots and lots and lots of ads, and some of them smell. You have your clothing and fashion ads, ads for beauty products, perfumes, moisturizers, you know, the things that I don't know what they do, but they look like they probably hurt, and of course, ads for diet and weight loss products. Well, that makes sense, since finding clothes that flatter your butt means you gotta get rid of the junk in your trunk, dog. But Glenn, you ask, don't these magazines also include articles designed to boost a woman's self-esteem? Yes, good question they do. Who's your cute little listener? But one write-up about being sexy at any size hardly balances the dozens of ads, columns, articles, and most important, pictures that are designed to inspire a futile goal, perfection. While tabloids aren't quite in the same category as the Vogues and Glamours of the world, these IQ-draining magazines aren't exactly innocent. I saw a recent issue. A friend gave it to me, I swear. Anyway, it had a two-page spread featuring a circled area of cellulite on Misha Barton's backside. And the idea was to make real women feel normal. You can polish it any way you want, but bullcrap is never going to turn into solid gold, and spin is never going to become reality. How are real women supposed to reconcile what is clearly being highlighted as undesirable with the reflections they see staring back at them in the mirror every day? Here's what tabloid publisher Louisa Hatfield told Australia's newspaper The Age in 2006. Quote, "Women are obsessed with body image. They think about their body image more than they think about their children. They think about it even more than men think about sex, which is about a million times a day, isn't it?" Cha-ching! That's the sound of cash registers going off inside the offices of fashion magazines and tabloids everywhere. Anything people are obsessed with, their homes, their kids, their cars, their pets, has a corresponding industry to cash in on it. Body image is no different. Now, if diets and Hollywood-approved weight loss drinks won't cut it, then some doctor will, literally. Oh, did I forget to mention how many plastic surgery ads those magazines have? Cosmetic surgery is now a $15 billion a year industry in America. The number of procedures from liposuction to foot facelifts, what the hell is that, has increased more than 800% in the past 15 years alone. Allow me to repeat that for you. 800%. But that probably doesn't come as much of a surprise if you've turned on television lately, from Dr. 90210 to the Real Housewives of Orange County. Plastic surgery has almost become routine. ADD moment here, Your Honor. If you're thinking about plastic surgery, head on over to awfulplasticsurgery.com. Have yourself a gander. "Oh, Glenn," you must be saying, "that stuff is just for celebrities and the very rich. Real people don't do that." First of all, stop interrupting me. I mean, whose CD is this? Mine or yours? Second, oh yeah? 2/3 of Americans who choose to get a little nip here and a bit of a tuck there make less than $50,000 a year.
That doesn't really sound like the caviar jet set to me, lover.
But more shocking than these people's incomes, or lack thereof, is their age. Of the millions of cosmetic procedures performed each year, hundreds of thousands of patients are between 13 and 19 years old. Instead of getting a set of new keys for a new car at graduation, more and more girls are asking for a set of something else. And apparently, parents are actually saying yes to this. Who are these people? What father in his right mind wants to give his daughter something that will make more men drool over her?
"Hey, Bill, your daughter's got a nice set of knockers on her."
Image is everything. That cute little marketing catchphrase has never been truer than it is right now. Without image and the importance that we place on it, there would be no industry built around selling its ideal. In other words, no image, no fashion industry. No fashion industry, no models. No models, no pictures. No pictures, no magazines. No magazines, no barfing of your daughter in the other room. It's a vicious cycle. The more we focus on image, the worse the body image problem becomes. Simple logic here, people. It does not, however, apply to the models featured in the photo spreads. The average American model is 5'11 and 120 pounds. Slap a size zero dress on a telephone pole, and you'll get a sense of what that's like. On the other hand, the average American woman is 5'4 and weighs 163 pounds. You bought the audiobook, so I'll do the math. That's 7 inches shorter and 43 pounds heavier than the cover girls. The more we focus on image, the worse the body image problem becomes. Simple logic applies. Let's say your 15-year-old daughter is better than average. She's 5'6 and weighs 125 pounds. I mean, what are you feeding that horse, man? By the new global standard of who's a fatty and who's not, or as the PhDs like to call it, body mass index, she's a 20.2. That's firmly in the healthy weight range. Unfortunately, that still makes her a fat, fat, fatty because she's 5 inches shorter and a few pounds heavier than the woman the fashion police suggest she model herself after. Apparently, better than average just isn't good enough anymore. Oh, what's that? Is that my little Laura vomiting in the other room? After 3 runway models died of self-inflicted starvation, the fashion industry wasted no time in imposing a public relations-driven guideline that any model walking on the runways from Madrid to Milan could have no less than 18.5 body mass index. Well, that sounds great. Yeah, sure does sound great until we do a little reverse math on the number. In order for a 5'4" woman to achieve that same BMI, she'd have to weigh a whopping, ready for this, 108 pounds. Well, considering that's a full 55 pounds less than average, most women will never really have to worry about the fashion industry's little foray into self-regulation. But someone who did have to worry about it was Victoria's Secret supermodel, Giselle, whatever her name is, what's in a name, look at her. She reportedly, of course, had to gain 14 pounds to walk the catwalk in Milan. For someone who's trained herself to be so thin for so long, Giselle first got into modeling at the age 13, I bet gaining weight was harder than losing it. Before you start telling me that I should at least appreciate the fact that the industry has tried to help, consider this. Guidelines are just that. Voluntary guidelines. When was the last time anything voluntary has forced real change? Young, skinny, impressionable girls may make good models, but they hardly make good role models. Consider, if you will, the evolution of what I like to call the prostitute. Maybe you can't take a ruler and draw a straight line between a celebrity-obsessed, self-indulgent culture and sexed-up outfits for 7-year-olds who want Botox shots before they hit up the next gymboree party, but it's an evolutionary change that is undeniable. Do you remember the foundation we talked about earlier? Yeah, well, if you were wondering what the end result of a shaky one looks like, it's this. A prostitute. Unfortunately, things don't exactly improve once your little prostitute hits her teenage years, even though every generation says they have the worst teens ever. Today, parents actually do. No, they do. A 2006 San Diego State University study found that the current crop of college students are, ready for this, almost twice as narcissistic and image conscious as they were 24 years ago. Some of that is because of the me-me-me culture of internet sites such as MySpace and Facebook and YouTube. Get off the computer, freak. But some of it has also got to be related to that shaky foundation that so many of these teenagers' formative years were built on. As our prostitute continues to evolve past her teenage years, or I should say it like they used to say it in science class in those films, as our prostitute continues to evolve past her teenage years, she usually reaches a place that only makes her body image worse. College. Here's a purely hypothetical example to show you what I mean. Let's say there was a small, bucolic private college in the Midwest. Let's call it DePauw University, merely for the sake of the story. One of DePauw's sororities, let's call it Delta Zeta. They decide to toss out all of the women who don't look like the stereotypical sorority girl that you may be familiar with from such classic vintage films as Animal House or Porky's 2, The Next Day, Porky's Revenge, or Revenge of the Nerds. Oh, those were classic films, weren't they? Well, actually, they don't say that's the reason, but the sorority's on-campus nickname, the Doghouse, doesn't leave much room for doubt. Anyway, after the girls are sent to the pound, DePauw ends up in the middle of a firestorm. Again, hypothetically, you know, this example is totally fictional, and has to shut down the sorority house and kick the remaining girls off campus, squarely onto their perfect little butts. Two morals to the story. First, it's obvious that looks, not friendship, love, or loyalty, are the only thing that really matters. And second, trying to mold your surroundings to look more like an episode of The O.C. doesn't create positive self-image. It means you're obsessed with it. My solution? The best present you could possibly give your kids this year isn't made by Sony, Dell. It's not made by Apple. Yeah, believe it or not. It actually costs much less than anything Apple could ever make. Although if they did make it, they would probably mark it down and sell it for about $200 less about a month later. It is an environment where they aren't being constantly targeted and bombarded by everything I've just described. It's something you build for them. Kind of a safety zone where they get to spend real time with their family rather than plopping down in front of a TV or a computer staring at Paris Hilton's night vision classics all evening. Although that was a super, super classic. And I know her grandfather built an empire in hospitality, but I don't think I'd invite Paris into my home, and neither should you. ADD moment. Okay, fine, sure. When I was single, I would have invited Paris into my house. But I wouldn't have felt good about it later. I wouldn't have. You know, my family has an unwritten rule. If we wouldn't spend time with them in real life, then don't let them into your living room via the television set either. It seems simple, but these days, we're not just letting those people into our living rooms. We're letting them right into our children's bedrooms. I don't mean to sound hypocritical, but every time I hear some crazy cable news pundit, present company excluded, of course, railing against celebrities for causing the poor self-esteem of our children, blood shoots right out of my eyes. I'm not kidding you. Celebrities are not the problem. Parents are the problem. Celebrities only have the power because we give it to them. But you know what? We've been doing that for ages, and things haven't always been this bad. Back in the 1930s, I'm sure plenty of kids admired Babe Ruth more than FDR. And the Babe was an alcoholic adulterer. But the difference between then and now is access. If the Babe were playing today, he'd probably have his own line of bourbon, along with a reality show taking you behind the scenes of his adultery. It's not the role models who are the problem. It's the constant and seemingly limitless exposure our children have to them. Fortunately, that's something we can change. Because we control the access. We control the horizontal and the vertical by controlling the purse strings. Is your 8-year-old part of the underground child labor market? No? Then someone in your house is giving her the money for the rhinestone baby fat tank top. ADD moment. Has anybody else noticed the disturbing trend of putting words on the butts of sweats and shorts? I mean, I haven't noticed because I never, ever, ever, ever look there, of course, but a friend of a friend of mine told me it's particularly trendy these days. I just look at him and pass the girls and say, "Man, those words on your butt, it makes the whole thing look fat." But that's with a PH, of course. I get how hard it is to shop for kids. In the not-too-distant past, I was out with one of my daughters at a popular retail outlet whose name I shall not repeat here, except to say that it may or may not rhyme with the crap. Anyway, we were looking for a pair of modestly cut, non-dorky back-to-school jeans. Who knew that would be an all-day project? Yeah, not me. Uh-uh. After looking around a little while, the fruit of my loins tried on a pair that, well, pretty much showcased the fruit of hers, shall I say. Honestly, it was borderline lingerie. So I ever so gently suggested that I didn't really think they were appropriate. And before she could tell me how old and out of touch I was, the 20-ish sales clerk with the nose ring did it for her. "That's not inappropriate," she said. "It's how everyone is wearing them these days." Now, what's funny is in most states, including the one I happened to be in at the time, it's illegal to kill another human being. And that came to mind at that moment. Consider that a lucky break for my new friend in sales at the crap. Because the law is the only reason she's still breathing, quite frankly. But I hope my daughter learned something from that whole debacle. Just because the store clerk likes to be led from trend to trend by her nose ring doesn't mean you have to follow, or will, quite frankly. But ultimately, the solution comes down to common sense. Have dinner together as a family tonight. Spend time with each other. Talk to each other. As parents, we need to start leading by example. Yes, the magazines, the ads, the plastic surgery, all part of the problem. But each time you try to squeeze your fat butt into a pair of size 4 true religion jeans, your daughters learn to pray at the same altar. There's a bit of dime store philosophy I picked up along the way somewhere, and it goes like this. That which you gaze upon, you will become. I don't know about you. I'm pretty happy to have my wife and daughters gaze upon Little Debbie and admire Betty Crocker, as long as we're all doing it together, as a family. Section 5. Blind Dating. Playing the Powerball of Love. Marriage often gets a bad rap, but actually it has quite a few benefits when you think about it. I mean, you no longer have to comb your hair, wear pants around the house, or, most important, go on a painfully awkward date, like any date with me. Of course, the most agonizing type of date out there is the blind variety. It is literally the bane of existence for anyone who's single, yet millions continue to suffer hopelessly through them every year. The evolution of the internet has only made things worse. Websites like eHarmony, Match.com, Love-A-Life, Hispanic Amish Widows Seeking Divorce Croatians.org, and a host of others are signing up millions of members and making e-fortunes off of people's strategically cropped, airbrushed photos and lack of conversation skills. ADD moment, no one is really honest in online dating. No one. Alcoholics check off, "What I drink socially." 3-pack-a-day smokers check the "on occasion" box. Everybody claims to be reading Nietzsche, and they're all easygoing. And of course, "I've never tried this before, so here goes," is the first line in 90% of profiles. Well, I'm here to end the misery. For just pennies a day, you can help a blind date sufferer finally get the sweet love he or she deserves. Yes, it's true, and I'll show you how. Somebody cue Suzanne Summers! My personal experience with blind dating has led me to the following conclusion. All blind date participants should actually be blind. That would solve a lot of problems, you know, if we actually did it. But until that happens, we're left with a bunch of desperate people who still have their vision and, consequently, their standards. When you get right down to it, isn't that really the problem? Really? Standards. I mean, after all, the only reason anyone is on a blind date in the first place is because they couldn't attract even the slightest interest from any living human being who has actually ever seen them. What makes you think that anyone who has been rejected by hundreds of millions of people is going to look like Jessica Alba or Brad Pitt? I'll tell you what, your standards, I hate to be the one to have to give you the hard truth, but time to get rid of them, really. We've all heard this line at one time or another. She's got a fantastic personality. Or, oh, he has just got a heart of gold. Yeah. Let me translate that for you. On a good day, they look like the love child of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Helen Thomas. The real estate industry uses certain code phrases to market properties that you need to know about to be successful. For instance, cozy means you'll barely fit. Blind dating is really no different. Someone marketed as having a fantastic personality is really O'Donnell-esque. Someone who likes to spend a lot of time at home, probably has a kid, or five, or is under house arrest. You just need to learn the lingo. You're probably hearing this now and thinking, but Glenn, looks aren't everything. Such a sweet spirit. What about connecting to someone's spiritual side? Yeah, I'll gladly give that to you. I did connect with my wife's spiritual side, but not on our first date. Maybe not even on our 31st date. Tanya's spiritual side is what will keep us together for all eternity, but it's not what brought us together. A different side of her was responsible for that. A lesser man would claim that it was her backside, but, well, hell with it. I am that lesser man. Let's be honest, if she looked like Pete Rose, I don't think we would have done so much connecting. Unless you're being set up with a flying nun or the ghost of Bing Crosby, save your spiel about spiritual connections for somebody else. There's no such thing on a first date. So, what does all of this mean, other than I'm extremely shallow? I'm honest. Unfortunately, that quality is missing from the vocabulary of most blind daters. And let's face it, the folks who are honest don't get a single email. Even though some websites and technology have helped take some of the blind out of blind dating, you still really have no idea what to actually expect once you show up. That's because honesty, particularly photographic honesty, is pretty hard to come by. The rules really shouldn't be that complicated. If you're a bald man, or woman, don't put a picture of yourself with hair from 1987 at a Whitesnake concert on your Match.com profile. The same goes for height and weight. If 300 pounds is your diet goal, you're not cuddly or voluptuous. You're gargantuan. And if you're a guy who rounds up his height to 5'2", you're not compact. You're a shoddier-looking version of Tom Cruise, without the fame, the hot wife, the cool spaceship religion. You see, honesty is such a major problem with blind dating that I'd go so far as to make it federal law. Let's call it the Truth in Dating Act. It would require both parties to send their prospective dating partner 3 unedited, unaltered photos, including at least one full body shot, taken within the previous 6 months, certified, notarized, you know, whatever it takes. But the Truth in Dating Act isn't so shallow as to be exclusively about looks. I mean, let's be honest, net worth matters as well, you know? Since a guy saying, I'm in sales, often really means, I'm hopelessly in debt. All men must come to the first date with their complete financial records and recent W-2 form, along with indisputable proof that they do not currently live in their parents' basement. Women, on the other hand, must provide medical records to prove that A, all of the lady parts have always been lady parts, and B, they're not completely and utterly insane. Any fraud would be dealt with swiftly and mercilessly. Both your fake and real pictures would be posted side by side on a free public website for everyone to enjoy. The conned dater would also post a short summary of the deceit, including any misleading emails from you describing yourself, Mr. Broke Fat Fat Fatty. You've probably heard about the book, The Rules, which purportedly reveals the surefire methods that women can use to hook men. Rules such as, don't accept a Saturday night date after Wednesday. I honestly don't even know what that one means. Don't talk to a man first. Yeah, here's another one. Don't ever ask him to dance either. Don't call him and rarely return his calls. All right, apparently every girl I met in high school read this book before it was printed. That's weird. Well, blind dating has rules in my book as well. Rules for men. 1. Treat the date as if you're hosting your own interview show. Women always say that men lose points whenever they talk too much about themselves. So shut the pie hole and let her do the talking. Obviously, you should avoid politics at all cost. Her reaction to, man, I gotta tell you, I really hope Cheney runs in 08, may not exactly be what you hope for. 2. Don't step in poop. I know it sounds simple, but I found that almost anything is forgivable on a first date, except stepping, you know, in dog poop. Trying to remove said poop by wiping your shoe on the front steps of a date's home really doesn't, in fact, I repeat, does not make things better. Trust me, this is one of those things I wish I would have read first rules. If you step in poop, excuse yourself from wherever you are and never, ever come back. 3. Floss before, not during the date. I've found that women don't appreciate you flossing at the dinner table with a matchbook, business card, piece of cutlery, or strand of their hair as much as you'd think, Jethro. Again, just one of those things I wish I would have read first. Consider yourself fortunate. Now, rules for women. 1. Cleavage is like bacon. The more, the better. I'm just saying. It doesn't matter what you look like. If you show your blind date a little cleavage, you could pretty much guarantee a second date, along with no eye contact whatsoever. Yes, we are that simple. Bottom line, guys aren't complicated. We're easily bordering on simian. Women should pity us. Really, you should. 2. Erase the past. Women, we get it. You've had boyfriends before us, but here's the thing. And I'll try to put this as gently as possible. We don't really care. Mm-mm. We don't want to hear about your ex, Larry, who laughed like a llama, or the last guy you dated who made you pay for dinner. Yeah, maybe you didn't get the memo, but it's over. That's pretty much why you're on this desperation date with us. Yeah, all coming back to you now, isn't it? 3. If you want us to kiss you at the end of the date, please, I'm begging here. Can you let us know? I speak unilaterally for all men when I say, we're clueless. We have no frickin' idea. We always assume you're not interested unless you give us extraordinarily overt hints, such as, you know, touching us on the leg, playing with your hair. I'm a little confused on that one, too. I kissed a teacher once, and that's a different story, so we won't go there. Or, you know, not interrupting the date to take a call from your ex-boyfriend. That's probably another good tip. My solution? Love at second sight. I never understand women who say, I wasn't attracted to him first, but then when I got to know him, I learned to love him. Come again? You learned to love him? What could that possibly mean other than he was 90 years old, wheelchair-bound, deaf, mute, but...
Once I found out he was worth billions, he turned into Jake Gyllenhaal.
Of course, guys are just not as superficial as women. They're more superficial. That's why it's in everybody's best interest if all blind dates are mandated to use the 2-minute drill. Get your mind out of the gutter here. It's not what you're thinking. The 2-minute drill is, I think, a very simple idea that would completely take all embarrassment and awkwardness out of a blind date. Who's not in favor of that? Okay, here's how it works. First, the daters meet at a prearranged, neutral public setting. Bars, restaurants, they're off limits. Think more like a park, a shopping mall, a busy wheat field. Places where people can size each other up from a distance and duck behind the wheat if necessary. Then, the daters slowly approach each other and close within 5 feet. Each party, respectively, then flexes his or her muscles and or bends down, pretending to pick something up. The other party observes. No words are allowed to be spoken. This is an important rule. Then, like in a rock-paper-scissors game, the daters hold out clenched fists and after 3 shakes reveal either a thumbs up or a thumbs down simultaneously. If either party shows a thumbs down, the date ends immediately, the parties scatter, go gather your wheat, no monies have been exchanged, no valuable time has been wasted. Frankly, blind dating never really worked out for me. From the awkward silence, to the restraining orders, to the chilling effect of my irrational opinions on conversation, it was pretty much all bad. Now, that doesn't mean it can't work for you, especially if you follow the guidelines I've just laid out here. And honestly, if you can get a complete stranger to stand in the middle of a wheat field and play a twisted version of rock, paper, scissors with you, that person probably is the one. Every day I count my blessings that my dating experience worked out the way it did. After all, if it had gone any other way, I may never have met my beautiful, loving, and understanding wife, the woman who puts up with me, takes care of me, mothers me like no other. And I mean that. I love you, Tanya. Section 6. The income gap. The rich get richer. Good for them! As John Edwards was making that speech and laying out his optimistic picture of America during the 2004 presidential campaign, he was also doing something else, purchasing 102 acres of land in Orange County, North Carolina. After losing the election, Edwards had plenty of free time to figure out what kind of house to build on that property, and he chose well. The main residence has 5 bedrooms and 6.5 baths. It connects via covered walkway to a gigantic recreational facility known as the Barn, which features an indoor pool, basketball, squash, and handball courts. Oh, and also its own stage. In total, the estate contains more than 28,000 square feet and cost $1 million more than any other home in the entire county. It also happens to sit directly across the street from a trailer park. I think John Edwards picked the right America to live in. Meanwhile, Edwards visited the other America, the lawn of a woman who lost her house to Hurricane Katrina to launch his 2008 presidential campaign. John Edwards just might be one of the globe's largest emitters of the phrase income inequality, and arguably the most hypocritical, but he's certainly not the only one. That phrase is an all-time favorite of politicians, right on the heels of the wealthiest 1%, gender gap, and my secretary stays in my hotel room when I travel to save the taxpayers money, and it's not hard to see why. After all, income inequality creates great mental imagery of evil, rich, bastards rolling in piles of cash while the poor suffer as a result of their unending greed. Let me be completely clear about something. I don't care about income inequality. I don't care if some people make a whole buttload more money than other people. In fact, I want that to happen because it motivates people to push themselves harder. It's actually a crazy function of something I like to call capitalism. And generally speaking, I'm for capitalism. What I do care about is that people are able to meet their basic needs, such as food, drink, shelter. If life is a stock market, I'm bearish on starving people to death. I also care about people having every opportunity to succeed financially if they work hard. No one should ever face an uphill battle simply because of race, gender, or anything else other than merit. If you really could get inside John Edwards' heart of hearts, I bet that even he would admit that he doesn't really believe that every person should have an equal chance to succeed. I would bet that he wants his kids to have a better opportunity than your kids. Now, that might sound cold, but if it's not true, then why wouldn't he buy a small home, send his kids to community college, and give the rest to that other America he spends so much time talking about? Is John Edwards working hard to save all of his money for a blowout funeral featuring the Rolling Stones, who at the time would approximately be 214 years old and probably still touring? No, he's working hard now so his kids can go to the colleges they want and have the best possible chance at success. But politicians can't say things like that. They have to shed a tear, you know, at least in public, any time they see something as unequal. Maybe it's time to, I don't know, go back and review what equality really is supposed to mean in America. It all starts with that little memo called the Declaration of Independence. Here's how most people read what I believe is one of the most important phrases in the history of the world, that all men are created equal. Well, what happens if I put the emphasis on a different word? It changes everything. That all men are created equal. That's right, Jack. Every man is created equal. It's what you do with it from there that makes a difference. We're all free agents in life. We make our own decisions. We control our own destiny. Stop and think about the families you know who have a few working-age children. Does every child in the same family earn the same amount of money? No? Well, gee, that doesn't make sense. I mean, they've got the same genes, the same parents, the same upbringing, the same opportunities. If the politicians who say that economic differences are caused by the evil system lining up to crush our spirits are right, then you'd think that all siblings would earn the same salary. That's weird, because they don't. Alec Baldwin makes millions, while his brother Billy, who entered the same field around the same time, makes as much as, oh, I don't know, maybe an armless tennis pro. Is that because of the unfairness of our system? Of course not. It's because different people have different levels of talent, they make different choices, and have different ideas about success. Also, some of them have drinking problems, but that's a different story. Think about two brothers who decide early on that their mission in life will be to help other people. One brother becomes a doctor. The other goes into the Peace Corps. Although their focus in life might be exactly the same, their tax returns are going to be a little different, don't you think? In fact, when examining income inequality in America, quote, sibling differences represent about 3/4 of all differences between individuals, end quote. That's according to research about family structure in the groundbreaking book, The Pecking Order. The majority of our differences in income lie within families, not between them. Politicians, most of them, with their names followed by the letter D, and their vision of modern-day robber barons living off trust funds by exploiting the poor, are simply not backed up by the facts. In 1916, the wealthiest 1% lived almost solely on inheritance and previously made wealth. Their huge stashes of old money continually churned out new money at such a staggering rate that the wealthiest people earned only about 1/5 of their income from actual work. Today, that number has tripled to 60%. But politicians have never been the ones to embrace stats that just don't fit their platform. They still love to paint the picture of an elite ruling class crushing the poor, while the reality is that advances in our quality of life have been widespread and impressive. Consider this. Between 1979 and 2004, the number of American households earning less than inflation-adjusted $75,000 per year decreased by 10.1%, while those earning more than $75,000 increased by the same amount. Translation, more people are earning more money. In that same time period, the median size of a newly built home increased from 1,485 square feet to 2,140 square feet. Close to 40% of all new homes are now built with four or more bedrooms, and 90% have central air. Between 1997 and 2003, the number of people with computers at home rose by 68%, and 206% more people obtained internet access. The inflation-adjusted net worth of the median family rose by 31% from midway through Bill Clinton's term to midway through George W. Bush's. Shockingly, a full 54% of Americans hold no credit card debt. However, if it's just the small detail of a missing Social Security number that's holding you back, Bank of America will help you out, I'm sure. Anyone who has ever had a savings account knows it's easier to make money when you have money. That's one of the reasons people try so hard to get rich in the first place. So what does it matter if life is getting better for some people faster than others, as long as it's getting better? There's a myth that America is the land of opportunity. The vision of income inequality does encourage one very serious condition. It makes people believe they can't make it. A study from American University called Understanding Mobility in America attempted to do just that. It concluded that people who grow up wealthy wind up having a better chance at staying wealthy.
Oh, well, geez, what a revelation! Did the same study uncover that people who grow up in America have a better chance of turning out American?
Apparently, if you grow up rich, there's a 22% chance that you'll stay that way. Surely that statistic proves the United States produces an abnormally large number of stupid rich kids. But that's not where these geniuses at the university named after America went. Instead, they focused on the finding that a person born poor has only a 1% chance of eventually being in the top 5% of wage earners. One analyst then went on to say that this debunks the myth of America as the land of opportunity. ADD moment here. America isn't the land of opportunity? Really? Have you taken a stroll on the beautiful shores of the Rio Grande lately? Those people aren't running over here in the dead of night because they want to visit Knott's Berry Farm. By the way, this study didn't even look at immigrants at all, which, if I remember my history correctly, was how the phrase land of opportunity started in the first place. It's that kind of ridiculous analysis that illustrates the real agenda from many on the left, conscious and unconscious. Make people believe they can't do it themselves, and then they'll become dependent on your help. Looking at the study's very own numbers, all inflation-adjusted, it's hard to understand its lack of optimism. It concluded that the average family's income rose by more than 35%, and the income per person in the household was up 153%, partially because we're having fewer children now. And that all happened in just the last generation alone. In fact, those who make the least amount of money, the bottom fifth of all earners, now have almost a 60% chance that their children will leave that group. Of those people, almost 60% move up more than one quintile. The land of opportunity, my friend, is alive and well. My solution? The problem isn't income inequality. The opportunity to rise is as ample as the opportunity to bed Paris Hilton. The real problem is figuring out how to maintain and ultimately improve the situation, and there are pragmatic ways to do so. But, as politically incorrect as it is, maybe the right approach isn't to try to find problems with the financial health of America. Instead, try to examine the financial health of the poor family in America. And here, I'm sorry to say, are the unpleasant facts.